Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Big Mouth Podcast. I'm Laura Barton, and I'll be your host for this week while Andrew Harrison does whatever mysterious thing Andrew Harrison does when he's not recording podcasts in a Soho basement. Possibly he's just outside getting some vitamin D. Today we're going to be discussing Björk's Utopia, Noel Gallagher's Who Built the Moon, Laura Mvula's God Made Me Funky, and Gregory Porter's Popular Voices. Joining me in our secret underground headquarters this week is Mr. Andy Miller, author of The Year of Reading Dangerously, co-host of the Backlisted podcast, reader-in-residence at Durham Book Festival, and the man I'd like to personally thank for introducing me to Gordon's Wine Bar. Andy Miller, what's your favourite song about books?
My favourite song about books?
Yes.
Oh, no.
On the spot.
Well, instantly one has to say Read It in Books by the Bunnymen.
Nice.
Right?
Yep.
But that's not my favourite. That was the one I said to buy myself a bit of time.
I can also offer you paperback writing.
My favourite song about books is An Open Book by Stephen Duffy and the Lilac Time, which is a bonus track on their album Keep Going.
Oh.
And when I was writing The Year of Reading Dangerously, when I was finishing it, I used to play it every day before I started work. And it's got a lyric that goes, sometimes you stay down from the knocks, you can't always come out on top.
That's lovely.
It's the most brilliantly depressing song. And when I saw Stephen Duffy and the Lilac Time playing in a church at Port Elliot 2 years ago, Stephen dedicated the song to me. And I, at that point, died and descended to an astral plane from which I still haven't returned.
Also with us in the pod is music writer, reef hater, port product aficionado, and someone I like to think of as the man who didn't even like Bruce Springsteen until I taught him the error of his ways, Mr. Michael Han. Han, how many port products have you had this week?
Oh, this week? Well, I've had bacon, I've had Wiltshire cured smoked back. I've had unsmoked streaky. I've had a Cumberland pork sausage roll from Morrison's. Scotch egg. Because I like to get a Scotch egg to eat while transporting the shopping from the shop door to the car.
How long is that journey? Just to have
it's long enough to eat a Scotch egg. Precisely.
Can you fit one in your mouth without
No.
biting it?
No.
Have you ever tried?
No, I haven't. What do you take me for? A barbarian? I've had some sausages and I had a bit of chorizo last night.
Very nice. I mean, I'm saying nice. I'm a vegetarian.
I know.
But this is a replication of what used to happen at The Guardian when Michael used to come around to my desk and talk to me about how the best way to make pork belly pork, have you?
Oh.
And I'm like, literally not the person to tell.
Well, I know you're not the person to tell, but I think you always liked hearing.
And beside us, reassuringly as ever, like the Gideon Bible of podcasts, is Mr. Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. Matt, what have you been baking this week? Because I follow you on Instagram and I love your baking adventures.
I've been a sourdough evangelist.
I saw them at the Dublin Castle.
Because you're always told when you read sourdough books about how, or books about baking, that how sourdoughs kind of last for centuries, and when you get married in kind of parts of Poland, they give the couple some of the kind of village sourdough which has been there fermenting for kind of, and finally somebody said to me, oh, have you got any sourdough, because I want to try baking some. So I actually was able to give them my not very old, only 3 year old rye starter, but it's also known as a mother.
That's nice.
Which is quite nice.
I also quite like the idea of sourdough books. When you're reading sourdough books, as you said.
There's always a bit of a bake when you get a bake, how to bake bread book. There's always a bit at the back which is like the sourdough bit. It's the kind of ninja bit that you only go into once you've kind of you feel ready for it. It's always a bit off putting.
Isn't when I'm reading sourdough books the Dalston hipster version of when I'm cleaning windows?
It is. There is currently a bloke with a ukulele and a beard singing that at the moment, even as we speak.
Before we commence, just a friendly reminder, if you use an Apple device, why not subscribe to Big Mouth via Apple Podcasts? You can do it via the podcast app on your phone or the iTunes Music Store. And why not give us a lovely review and star rating too? It all helps butter up the evil algorithms that control everything and gets it into the ears, hearts and minds of more listeners. We will be exceedingly grateful. Android people, so I like to call them just androids, don't despair. You can get us on, is this Stitcher, Matt?
I don't know.
I don't know this technology. Stitcher and Audioboom 2, as well as Spotify. So, while the world hangs around waiting for an Oasis reunion, Noel Gallagher has been busy making a new album with his band, Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds. As a side point, I really don't think they should let Noel Gallagher name bands. Anyway, Who Built the Moon is his third post-Oasis album and has been produced by the legendary David Holmes, known particularly for his work on soundtracks such as Ocean's 11, Out of Sight and Hunger. Here's a taste of the album with the track It's a Beautiful World. Michael Hann, what did you make of Who Built the Moon?
Well, I keep thinking back to the interview that Noel Gallagher has given on the cover of the new Q magazine, where he's talking about how he's done something different. And he says, the Parker Monkeys are going to be like... No, I'm not going to do any kind of accent. Parker Monkeys are going to be like a fucking French bird on a track. No, mate, not having it. It's not rock and roll. My problem with this is that Noel Gallagher, you are the man who encouraged those Parker Monkeys to ask the question, who's having it? I'm not having it. And Noel, look, before Jay-Z came to Glastonbury saying, Jay-Z at Glastonbury, I'm not having it. So it feels to me kind of insincere, these protestations about how he's always really wanted to be a musical adventurer. That said, I don't think the album's that good. It does sound to me exactly like what he says it is, a man who went into the studio without any songs and put them together with the producer. There is one amazing moment on it, which is Holy Mountain, which is one of the best songs in years and years and years because it sounds like a cheap glam B-side from 1974, where all the production tricks actually work with the song. So the horns are great. The what sounds like a tin whistle underneath the chorus is great. The brilliant stupidity of the chorus is great. I mean, it's not stupid like some Oasis songs could be. It's kind of brilliant stupid. But that is by some distance the best thing on it. Black and White Sunshine sounds like it's a bit of a song. It's got a terrific guitar hook that coincidentally sounds very much like it could have come from something released on the mid-80s, in the mid-80s on Creation, before Noel got to Creation. The lyrics seem to be reliably crap throughout when one can make them out, because Noel is very low in the mix, which is probably a good thing because he actually isn't much of a singer. And once again, there is nicking, although this time he's nicking from different things. He's not nicking from the Beatles anymore. Well,
he does nick from the Beatles in places, though.
Not as much as usual.
No,
I mean, keep on reaching. Nicks from Sly and the Family Stone.
There's one that sounds like Come Together. There's one that sounds like Come Together.
There's one that sounds like...
The purpose of which is to sound
Plastic
like Come
Bertrand,
Together.
Plastic Bertrand, isn't there? And there's one that sounds a bit like Gene Pitney.
I thought there was one that sounded an intro a bit like Good Day Sunshine.
But we can't tell off Noel for nicking things. That's been his whole career. So it's just that he's nicking...
I had the thing with this record, which I've seen people talking about quite a lot, which is that I was in my kitchen and I had the radio on going about normal everyday activities. It was Radio 2. And a tune came on the radio and I dropped the parsnip I was peeling at the time and went...
A parsnip dropper?
What's this?
I saw a parsnip dropper in the castle.
And I was thinking, what's this? This is terrific. Wow, what's this? And I go and got a pen and a piece of paper. And then whoever it was said, and that's the new Noel Gallagher single. I once again...
Holy Mountain!
I picked the parsnip up and dropped it again to emphasise the double shock that I'd received. I just thought it was terrific. I agree with you, Michael. It's probably the best track on the album. And my hope was... I mean, I don't think I haven't listened to a new Noel Gallagher-related project all the way through for some considerable time. But I was thinking... Imagine what this album would be like if there's 10 more bangers like this and no lachrymose ballads. It will be tremendous, right? And sadly, that isn't the case. But I like it a bit more than Michael did.
I don't dislike it. I just found it a bit dull, to be honest. Because it's meant to be the different Noel album, the bold step into the unknown. But all that means is it doesn't sound exactly like the Beatles. What it sounds like is yet another wholly conventional post-Britpop album where some guitar band has gone, let's get a dance producer in.
I disagree. Matt, do you disagree?
I disagree. I mean, I've got to say that it doesn't... the first track, which just sounds like something that could have come off a David Holmes kind of like, let's rip up this movie's crap, let's rip up the seats, or one of those kind of really great kind of compilations that he put together around the kind of turn of the century. And I thought, this is going to be really exciting. This is Noel meets the Chemical Brothers that he always wanted to, you know, always claimed that he wanted to do. It doesn't kind of sustain that, but there is enough interesting stuff. I mean, you know, at what point in the previous 20 years, I don't know, the career, yeah, would he have ever considered putting a French female vocalist to sing a kind of middle, or to dictate a middle eight in the middle of one of his records?
Well, to Noel's credit, he said that after Setting Sun, he wanted to go off in that kind of direction with Oasis, but the rest of the band said no.
This is
not
question,
having it.
This is totally, I mean, this was the thing I was going to say about the record. I've played it a few times. I really enjoyed listening to it. All the time thinking, why has it taken you 20 years to inch this far along the road to this record? You could imagine this in a different world, as you just said. This could be the record that Standing on the Shoulder of Giants turned out to be. What do we do after Be Here Now? We make a bolder move forward. And, of course, they didn't do that. And it's taken him six more albums to inch down the road to recruit David Holmes, who he could have recruited like 20 years ago anyway, because David Holmes was around then.
Yeah. Well, the other problem is he's done this at a point where his songwriting is not what it was. I mean, songwriters do not last forever. They can't keep on producing great songs. They just run out of things. And so this album has a lack of indelible choruses. And if great Noel Gallagher records are about one thing, they are indelible choruses. And so I think Holy Mountain is the only one really on this record that sticks with you.
Love Is the Law is my favourite on it, which is the one that sounds to me a bit Gene Pitney.
Yeah, I like I like Black and White Sunshine too, because of its none more Ruttles lyric, qu'est-ce que c'est now, in the chorus. That is magnificent.
But of course, talking about a kind of light-fingered approach to songwriting, I put Love Is the Law into Spotify, and of course it's not available on Spotify yet. What is available is the track by the Seahorses called Love Is the Law, and you kind of go, oh, if it's come to this.
It's an Aleister Crowley quote.
Do what thou
wilt.
Yeah.
But I'm interested, Laura, because normally I would be surprised by you being a staunch defender of a Noel Gallagher record, and I want to hear why.
I'm surprised myself. I think, I remember back when Oasis began, with Definitely Maybe, which is probably the only Oasis album I like, there was something very thrilling and exciting about that sound, even though it was harking back to the Beatles and whatever. But I think it is because of David Holmes, and it's because his music, I think, makes you feel you're on the edge of something dangerous and exciting and something new. And that's what he's done. I mean, not the actual songs, the lyrics, obviously bobbins, but the stuff around it, I mean, you can predict the rhyme three paces behind, but I think the music around it makes him sound relevant and exciting again.
Also, it reminds you of what he's good at, right? Mm. You know, when they ask, if they ask British people, if they do a survey of British people, what do you want from a restaurant, right? They don't want the cured meats we were discussing earlier. they judge it on two things. Is there a lot of it, and is it hot, right?
And
by the same token, right? But in the same token, what Noel is extremely good at, and you can hear it on this record, is finding that sweet spot in a melody and then building everything around it. Right, the point in the record where his voice sits, what the lyrics sound like, even if they rarely mean something beyond the general feeling. And my feeling is that on this record, there are quite a few moments like that where he hits it again and again. It's
and
the
I'm
thing he's good at.
I even like the Lacrimose ballads.
Do you?
I think because I think if he'd gone all out, it would have been a bit too Kasabian or something. I think he's known for a good Lacrimose ballad. And I think I needed those occasionally.
I just want to actually call you up on this cured meat thing. I didn't talk about cured meats at all. I talked about bacon and sausage. And before I came here, I had a sausage and egg McMuffin. I had some chorizo early in the week, but I also had bacon and sausage.
Was it sufficiently hot?
It was, actually.
Okay. Was the bacon dry, cured and smoked?
It's just from Morrison's, mate.
That
just from
mean
Morrison's.
It's not dry, cured and smoked. Before we move on,
the Parker blokes aren't going to like one.
We've already had a quote from a Noel interview, and obviously for the last few years he's been known more for his interviews than his music. I just wanted to share with you my favourite quote from when I interviewed him, and he told me, like some modern day George Orwell, about how to make a cup of tea.
And he said, I should be able to do the accent tonight. It's my neck of the woods, but I'm not going to. Yorkshire tea, very strong, with one sugar. The colour of it has to look like the big flat gold one in a quality street. The tea bag must be left in for any less than a minute and a half and it's down the sink. If it's left in for any longer than 3 minutes and it's gone. You've got the golden window of 1.5 to 2.5 minutes, which is something my wife is yet to fucking master. Can I swear?
Well, a bit late for that now.
When she says to me, do you want me to make you a cup of tea? I just say, no, I'll do it myself. Thank you very much. Black mugs are a disgrace. They are fucking awful things. I don't mind a cup and saucer, but a mug, a white mug, if it's got a blue stripes around it, it's got to be the perfect picture.
Oh, see,
That's very Brexit as well, the white mug with the blue stripe, right?
I kind of love Noel Gallagher as well for an interview he gave in Esquire 3 or 4 years ago when he complained about the state of British music, which he said was entirely the result of young bands. All the young bands just wanted to get in The Guardian, so they'd do what the music editor of The Guardian wants.
It's true.
That was me. He made me the most powerful man in British music. It wasn't true, sadly, but I loved it.
Yeah, plus every year that you worked as The Guardian music editor, you were railing about the fact that there weren't more bands wearing paisley shirts, playing 12-string Rickenbackers, and sounding like they'd just walked out of Rowan and Martin's Laughing.
My favourite Noel Gallagher quote is one that he was in an interview in the NME. I reckon it must be about 15 years ago. Where if they put to him, you know, but, you know, your music's very derivative, isn't it, Noel? It's like a mat. It's all the things we've just been saying. He said, but there's nothing new left to do. There's nothing new. I mean, who's doing something new at the moment? Stereolab. And who gives a fuck about them? And I love Stereolab, but there's an inherent truth there.
Right, let us have some more music. Each week, we implore our guests to bring in a tune they're particularly enjoying right now. And that they wish to share with the world. Andy Miller, what have you brought to show and tell today?
So I've brought in a track called The Age of Miracles by the Clientele, and it is the final track on their first album for 7 years, which is called Music for the Age of Miracles. I really love the Clientele. If anybody doesn't know what they sound like, they are, once again, they are bookish. Their record sleeves look like books.
Are they actually books?
Is that what you're saying? There's a brilliant... Their album, Strange Geometry, if you're listening to this now, which you clearly are, otherwise you wouldn't be able to hear me, but Strange Geometry by the Clientele. If you were to go and look at the cover of that, is the most perfect twilight suburban railway viaduct 1960s penguin knockoff cover. It's so beautiful. Anyway, they sound like they sound a bit like the Kinks, but by someone who's read an awful lot of Arthur Machen. So it's all about seeing the eerie, unearthly side of the suburban street at twilight. And this new record is it's a song cycle. And this final track is the point at which lyrically and musically everything coalesces in one final chord. And the effect of it is a bit like, I was talking about Sondheim earlier, but the effect of it is a bit like in Sunday in the Park with George by Sondheim, where he holds off the tonic chord in the thing until the very final song. So it feels like you've reached this incredible journey of wholeness and completion at the end of the show. And it's a bit like with this LP and this track.
Beautiful. That was The Age of Miracles by the Clientele. Now, Utopia is Björk's 9th studio album. It features the Venezuelan electronic musician and producer Arca, a choir, and a 12-piece Icelandic female flute orchestra. Let's hear a snippet of first single, The Gate. was The Gate from the new Björk album Utopia. Michael Hann, are you a fan of a flute orchestra?
Can we all just, before we answer that question, can we all lay bets on which way Michael's going to jump?
I think it depends whether or not it's all female and Icelandic.
I'm not opposed to flute orchestras. I think flute orchestras very much have their place. I love the sound of the flute. I'm not sure how much I love the sound of Björk's album. Björk is one of those people who makes me feel like I'm a caveman whose tastes are wholly unevolved. And the kind of man who would eat scotch eggs between a Dover supermarket and his car. Truly, actually, that is a dichotomy, because Björk would never do that, would she? I mean, the prospect
she would, but she'd
for
record
doing
it.
Or she'd eat one of those kind of puffins that they bury for like three years.
I know. I listened to Utopia, and I thought, my thoughts on this record genuinely would be roughly equivalent to me trying to assess the literary merits of Trifle. It just exists in a completely different plane from what I'm capable of assessing. It makes literally no sense to me. I think with artists of Björk's stature, I'm not trying to say Björk's crap or anything. Clearly she's not. Clearly this is an intelligent and brilliant woman doing exactly what she wants. I think there is an issue that she's at the stage in her career, and probably has been for some time, where she doesn't get A&R'd. No one will ever say, I don't think that's a very good idea. And so I find, 71 minutes this album. It's just way, 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 way too long for pretty much any record. And it only starts to make sense to me in the final third, when we get to the track Claimstaker. I was about to say Chainsmoker, projecting. That run from there on, Claimstaker, Paradisa, Saint, Future Forever, are just much more conventionally structured. I mean, they're using acoustic instruments largely, the flute orchestra, and suddenly the melodies become apparent and you can work out why the songs are the way they are. But for the 50 minutes before that, it just sounds like a cacophony. I found myself listening to it thinking, I don't understand why this song has come out this way. Like the Noel album, it's something that sounds, I believe that, this time Björk and Arca went into the studio without fully formed songs, like the Noel thing, and worked out there. And again, it sounds like it. And I think there's one thing in common on both those albums, which is just pointless use of sound effects all over the place, that you find yourself ignoring the song, just trying to work out what that noise that's really irritating you in the background is. I'm sorry, I feel bad saying this, because I feel like there's this kind of union where you're meant to say everything Björk does is amazing, and I don't understand her.
Andy Miller, what are the literary merits of Trifle?
What are the literary merits of Trifle?
Or what do you
it's
think
very
the
well
Björk
structured.
It's got beginning, middle,
and end. Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Michael said there. I thought that I found the first half of the album relentlessly interesting. It just refused to offer up anything you could really, really hang on to. And then the second half I enjoyed a lot more. And I actually played it the other way round to see if that worked. It does work much better if you start from track 8 and then work your way back round. So maybe the sequencing is partly a problem, I don't know. And I also feel with Björk, well, we'll come on to this. I'm going to hold this thought. The other thing I thought about, it's funny that we were listening to this in the same week that we were listening to Noel Gallagher, and I was thinking Björk gets a much easier ride than Noel Gallagher, because a lot of the criticisms which are consistently laid at Noel's door, clearly the sounding like the Beatles is not one they have in common. Lots of the other ones are. This is another Björk record, another relentlessly interesting Björk record to follow all the previous relentlessly interesting Björk records after she made debut, stroke definitely maybe, with the tunes on, and then decided she wanted to do other stuff, right? Well, that's fine. That is her prerogative. One of the issues that I have with her, which I constantly got snagged on while I was listening to this, is she a good singer?
Oh, my God.
She's a great musician. She's a great musician. Tonally, she's completely fascinating. She could be singing anything. Her relationship to her own lyrics is almost as meaningless as Noel's relationship to his. If you see her lyrics written down, they're often terrific and they're interesting. But she's so interested in turning her voice into a a flute or a piece of bird song or part of the texture of the music, that I find myself uninvolved.
Yeah, I got really hung up at times on her enunciation. So I was thinking about the way the words are said rather than what the words might actually mean, which I think she has an incredible voice, but I get what Andy says completely. I think that doesn't necessarily always translate into great singing. Because when you spend 3.5 minutes of one song, not thinking about what the song's doing, but wondering why she's gone, instead of literally gone, literally!
I think she can
She can roll an R like nobody's business, and I think that's brilliant. I was wondering whether... I mean, I really like this record, I've got to say. I thought it was... I haven't listened to a Bjork album in anger for a number of years, but
you haven't looked Bjork in anger.
Thank you. but I was really pleasantly surprised by this because it sounded a really happy record, and she was having fun, you know. And there's that track. Is it Features Creatures where she's talking about being in love and knowing that she's kind of 5 minutes from someone and she hears someone speak.
That's track one in my version.
Using the same accent as her kind of new partner, new boyfriend, new lover. And she gets really excited and she really conveys that brilliantly.
Her intonation is one of the things I most love about her singing, and that I could listen to the tracks that you both find most difficult. I don't have a problem with them because I'm waiting for those beautiful intonations. That's one of the highlights for me. Michael Hann is looking at me as almost like a...
I'm just raising a single eyebrow to put you off that.
Thanks.
No, I feel really conflicted because I kind of think I should like Björk.
Well, if you don't, you don't. But I mean, I also, you know, there's a huge wall of Björk albums that I sometimes feel a bit about. But then when I find my way in, or if I see her live, particularly if I see her live, I just feel overwhelmed with emotion whenever I see it. When she had the all-female choir for, was it Biophilia? That was one of the most emotional gigs I'd ever been to in my life, and I imagine it will be a similar effect with flutes this time. But and in a condensed form, that's what I get when she does a kind of sound or whatever.
You sound just like my cat there.
What was the a cappella record? Was that Vespertine?
Was that Vespertine? Was beautiful.
See, now I love that record because, and that's partly because her voice with other voices, her own, or Robert Wyatt's on that record as well, isn't he? That seems to be a far more both daring but central kind of way of approaching what her strengths as a musician are.
I liked Volnicura as well, because I mean, there was a human story at the heart of that, and also it helped, I think, knowing what the human story is going into the record. Whereas with this, you know, okay, well, the last one was the terrible breakup record, you don't really know what this one is, but I think fundamentally I just realised that the older I get, the shallower I am.
Do you know what? I'm not going to refute that. One of the things that I think helps a little bit sometimes with strangely structured Björk songs, I interviewed her once and she said, basically all my anecdotes are going to be, I interviewed her once and she said that when she's singing on stage, she's not thinking about the audience or the musicians around her or anything else, except she is seeing her songs as architecture and structures. And I kind of, if I find one that's oddly structured now, I try to imagine it more in that 3D way. Yeah. That's going to be the most pretentious thing that's ever been said.
Well, when she's singing, I'm not thinking about the audience or the musicians or anything either. I'm thinking about sausages.
She was interviewed by Marianne Hobbs on Six Music a couple of weeks ago, and she was talking about, just from what you were saying, Michael, about it, it felt that they were gone into the studio with the stuff half formed. And she was saying that when she gets people to produce stuff now, she wants them to kind of meet her halfway. She doesn't just want people. She doesn't go in wanting people to just shine things up. She wants, you know, it to be a proper collaboration. And she only chooses people who she can do that with. And I think sometimes that's not worked.
Well, that's an interesting, because after Volnicura, Arca got a lot of the credit for Arca.
Yeah.
And Björk gave some interviews where she said, no, this is not his record. This is my record. Yeah. I wrote these songs. We went in the studio with him and he produced them. It's my record. I got the impression from many other things that this is very much a change for her.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, but that hasn't worked in the past for me. Sometimes some of the kind of techno artists she's worked with have been too it's been too much kind of like It's Techno with Bjork on, singing on top, which hasn't worked. But I think this works really nicely.
I agree. Shall we have Michael Hann's musical offering? Hann, what he brought today?
The track is Holding On by Anna Turnheim from the album All the Way to Rio. Anna Turnheim is someone I was literally unaware of until I was asked to review this album by The Guardian. And I picked it up at the start of this week, thinking, right, well, let's see what this is like. And I was absolutely not for six by the whole record. It's one of my favourite records of the year. It's only 8 tracks, so it has the great advantage of brevity, which is something that should always be celebrated. You'll be unsurprised to hear, given what I've said about Bjork, that it's a record that operates very much within traditional song forms and hits loads of my sweet spots. Kind of autumnal melancholy, guitar arpeggios, kind of reminiscent of REM at their most pastoral. On this track, something a little more spiky. I picked the spikiest track on the album, but even so, it's barely spiky at all. I think it's glorious and beautiful. I mean, she's a proper pop star in Sweden.
Like a shaved cactus.
You know, number one, number two albums.
They were good too.
Saw them at the Dublin Castle. And I would recommend this record to absolutely anyone. Honestly, it's half an hour of your time that you will not begrudge.
Holding On by Anna Turnheim. Now, Gregory Porter is a soul and jazz singer from Bakersfield, California. In 2014, he won a Grammy for his album Liquid Spirit, an album that, if I remember rightly, featured the song Hey Laura, a song I personally could really do without.
Do people think they're being really funny when they sing it to you?
And it's a really stalky song. Porter currently has a series on BBC Four named Gregory Porter's Popular Voices, not to be confused with Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds. The series looks at some of the world's greatest singers, and episode one focused on the showstoppers, artists such as Caruso, Mahalia Jackson, Freddie Mercury, Prince, Ella Fitzgerald, Whitney and Mariah. In short, singers with hefty lungs and startling range. Shall we hear a little bit of Prince to set the scene, stops snickering.
No, I'm just thinking, I think it should have been called Gregory Porter's Hefty Lungs.
It's not too late. Kiss by Prince. Andy Miller.
Yes.
What did you make of these so-called popular voices?
I mentioned Robert Wyatt a moment ago, and I went to a talk that Robert Wyatt gave a few years ago, and one of the questions that he was asked is, Robert, what have you been listening to recently? That's one up only from where do you get your ideas from, Robert?
Where do you get your name from?
and he said, I've been listening a lot to people who sing in tune. And I thought that was a brilliant and profound thing to say. And he went on to say, as I get older, what I value more and more is less technique, though I like technique, but more people who can, through natural ability, have been blessed with a voice that occupies the centre of the note. And the singer that he mentioned was Nat King Cole. He said, when I listen to Nat King Cole, I hear somebody who's set up a harmonic resonance which the whole creation kind of flows out of, and it's just done apparently by him opening his mouth and singing. And the reason I mention that is, firstly, because Gregory Porter has an album out covering Nat King Cole stuff.
He does.
But from what I've heard of it, over-singing it.
Yep.
Because of where we are in how we judge what good singing is, yep, which is partly what this show was about. And also because the notion of showstoppers, which this programme was about, I would be really interested to see the other programmes in this series to see how they approach the singer as
servant of the song.
Or an interpreter of the song.
There's a lot in this. There was a lot in this programme about melisma. And it reminded me of a brilliant story that the singer-songwriter Jimmy Webb tells about being in a bar in New York with his friend, the singer-songwriter Billy Joel. And when Jimmy Webb and Billy Joel have been clocked by the piano man, if you will, and the vocalist, they launch into "Just the Way You Are" by Billy Joel, and they really go for it because Billy Joel's in the house. And they get to the end, she gives it the full melisma, and they get to the end, and Billy Joel stands up as though to give a round of applause, and he doesn't give a round of applause. He says, "The next time you sing that song, just sing the tune I fucking wrote." And I spent a lot of this programme going,
"What's about it?
This
never,
is fine.
This is.
I spent watching the singers, thinking, this is fine, but you know, the song doesn't always exist for you to have a platform to canter around in any direction you want."
Yep. I always say that I've written about this for you, actually, Ham, once, but about melisma and versus Van Morrison as I did it. But he's one of my favourite singers, even though he sounds like rain on wet slate. And he barely even sings words and is grunting and scatting and all the rest of it. But that, it just unravels me quite a bit.
Whereas melisma, you said, was a skill equivalent to being able to peel a potato in a single perfect spiral.
I think it was
spiral.
An apple, actually.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yes, pay attention, editor.
I started watching this and started thinking, oh, God, it's the same old people and they're only doing it because they've managed to get hold of various people to interview and various bits of footage to play, which is always the curse of the compilation documentary. However, I did find it interesting because I've always poured scorn on the melisma technique and really don't like it. I don't think it works as a... I find it really distracting for all the reasons that Andy said. But I liked the way that they talked about it from the point of view of coming out of the church and how he kind of traced back the, you know, looking at kind of Mahalia Jackson. And there was some amazing footage of Mahalia Jackson with her hairdo or kind of really kind of like being inhabited by the Holy Spirit. And I'd say if you haven't seen it, then go back onto the iPlayer and watch it just for that, because her hairdo's coming out, bits of hair, you know, and she's just kind of take, you know, away and just off on a plane, and it's brilliant. And she has a, you know, and then it kind of went through and kind of, you know, Whitney Houston, and it was just really, I thought that was a really interesting strand. And
I agree with that, the technical side. Once they got onto the technical side, I thought that was really, really interesting.
Yeah. I found it quite interesting, but I thought it was quite a cynical programme. I think it's out now because Gregory Porter has an album out now. I think Dave Grohl...
Well, that's what happened.
I think Dave Grohl was interviewed because they knew what the transmission date would be, and Dave Grohl has an album out now. I think Josh Homme was interviewed because they looked at the transmission date, and Josh Homme has an album out now. I don't know, but I suspect Freddie Mercury was in there because the producers looked at the list of what the first programme was and went, apart from Caruso, who no one really cares about anyway, this is all black singers, we better get someone white in there because this is BBC 4 and it's an overwhelmingly white audience, we want to give them something they can hang on to.
That's maybe a little bit harsh, but yeah.
I don't know, Matt, come on. You and I have both been in production, and we know the cynicism of decisions.
Michael sees
the
darkness.
I think the argument might have been, actually, you know, nobody knows who Mahalia Jackson is, and actually we need to put Freddie, you know, somebody who headlines stadiums and...
I thought there was too much unchallenged hyperbole. You know, when Grohl says that Freddie Mercury sang like Little Richard Woman and Pavarotti the next... No, he didn't. Yeah. You know, I'm not saying Freddie Mercury was a rubbish singer. Clearly he wasn't. But he did not sing like Little Richard Woman and Pavarotti the next. Too much of it was just Gregory Porter with some headphones on going, this is great, I really love this. Okay, mate. Well,
there were my highlight was that all the footage of, apart from Hayley Jackson, was the footage of Gregory Porter walking down a street. Lovely to watch.
And the other cynical thing was him in the studio duetting with Ella Fitzgerald, which annoyed the fuck out of me. I thought the really cynical thing was the setups, those cinema scenes where you see him sitting in the cinema with the artists on the screen in front of him, and you can see that it's video footage that's been digitally superimposed.
Yeah.
Then you cut to him crying over Mahalia Jackson. You think, I don't believe it, because I don't believe Mahalia Jackson's on that screen, and I don't believe he's crying at the footage.
But also, you know,
he was watching Finding Nemo.
You know, they obviously thought, somebody obviously thought, we need to put Ella Fitzgerald in this series somewhere. And like you, Andy, I don't know what the next few episodes are going to be. I hope there is an interpreter of the you know, some looking at people who interpret songs. And surely that is where you put Ella Fitzgerald alongside Frank Sinatra as the kind of possibly the greatest female interpreter
also,
of the American songbook.
It's also
songbook
the longer
ever.
The harder you look at this, the more sort of arbitrary it seems, because you would put Sinatra. No melisma for Sinatra, but you would describe Sinatra as both the servant of the song and a total showstopper. That's the in performance. That's what he was about. He's selling the song, but he's also selling Frank Sinatra as the personality.
Yeah,
audience.
I think with these people, he was going for the big voices, and Sinatra usually was not about the big voice. I mean, there are some performances, you know, the crescendo, the climax of "I've Got You Under My Skin." But a lot of his stuff is about restraint. And so it is about serving the song.
Yeah, yeah,
I think that's different.
So this should be about high notes, right? There was that bit about hitting high notes.
I mean, one thing that surprised me, it reminded me how much I liked Visions of Love by Mariah Carey and how little I liked Emotions.
I would just like to add one other thing. That if people haven't listened, and surely they have by now, but the interview that Adam Buxton did on his podcast with Johnny Marr is, I think, probably the best interview I've ever heard with Johnny Marr. And towards the end of that interview, he talks about seeing Mariah Carey do a show with the Smiths in the 80s. And he said at the time, we stood there going, oh, this is rubbish, because we disdained Mariah Carey and everything. She's not Mariah Carey, Whitney Houston, forgive me. We disdained Whitney Houston and everything she stood for. But now I think about it and I realise it was one of the greatest musical performances I've ever seen in my life. She got off the plane. She was jet lagged. They put her in makeup. They stuck the backing track on. She knocked it out of the park. She went off, got on a plane, flew somewhere else and did it again. He said it's just as an expression of sheer A, talent, and B, hard work. He said it's not like anything I've ever seen.
May I say to conclude that area that for me this was one of the examples of TV doing a documentary really badly. Not really badly, but badly in a way that radio does beautifully. And I think that kind of leads us maybe into the final segment, which is Laura Mvula's God Made Me Funky. Do we want to start with a little Mahalia Jackson, which kind of leads us between the two?
Why not? Just a closer walk with thee, granted you, Lord, if you please. Daily, daily walking close with thee. Oh, let it be, dear Lord, Lord, let it be.
So that was Just a Closer Walk with Thee by Mahalia Jackson. On Radio 2 at the moment, the British singer and former gospel choir director Laura Mvula is exploring the presiding power and influence of gospel music. In episode 1, Mvula was looking at gospel in the early 1950s and 60s, its relationship with the blues and its role in creating soul music, drawing on the work of artists such as Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles and James Brown. Andy Miller, how did you get along with Laura Mvula?
I found this enjoyable in a way I wasn't expecting to enjoy it, insofar as a documentary, it clearly wasn't much of a documentary. Mm-hmm. It's a record show.
Yes,
But the records that she played. There was a particular record called That's Enough by Brother John Witherspoon.
Which I've written down as well. Yeah.
Right, now she said Laura Mvula said at some point in that programme that what she loved about gospel was that the way that it sort of melts other forms of music down into it, or you can now hear echoes of other types of music. And that record, that Brother John Witherspoon record, not Father John Misty, not Father John Witherspoon's, Brother John Witherspoon, I've written it down, really reminded me of a record by the Human Beans called Nobody But Me, which is on Nuggets and is therefore a garage rock staple. But it was also, Nobody But Me was also a Northern Soul.
It was a nice floor filler song before the Human Beans.
And then it's also, you can hear blues and gospel in it. And so what I found so interesting was when people are playing Nobody But Me 50 years ago, they're not going, wow, this is gospel. But to hear it now, if you played those two records back to back, the extraordinary, some kind of like Farfisa organ part on That's Enough was just... beautiful.
There's a really brilliant website, or there used to be, called Midwest 45s. So I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's and it's sort of, it's records that have been found in sort of garage sales and wherever all over the Midwest, and you get a mix, and they're done into sort of categories, and there's gospel and all kinds of things, and the overlap in them is quite extraordinary. It's a bit like a sort of slightly more separated, less curated version of the sort of Numero Group, local custom style stuff, but it's really worth taking a look at just to see that how gospel bleeds into a lot of stuff.
She also was talking about records on here that had been suppressed or all copies burnt.
Yeah.
Or,
oh, yeah,
because
was it,
they were deemed to be too
Trevor Dandy.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's right. also, it reminded me of what John Savage wrote about records in the 60s. I mean, he was talking about psychedelia, but you could equally apply it to soul and northern soul and gospel, which is the reason why 50 years later people are still finding amazing records that had disappeared or been neglected, is because of economics. It was such a boom that there were so many records produced that there were far more records than could be listened to in one decade. And therefore, it's taken 50 years of sifting, and we're still not at the end of it.
No, there's apparently, I've not been, but I know people who, for holidays, go over to the States and basically travel around and spend all of their time in kind of dusty warehouses in industrial parks on kind of in the back streets of Memphis, and literally come out with tons of amazing kind of 7 inches that nobody's heard of.
Actually,
before.
You don't want to go to Memphis. You want to go to more like Dubuque, Iowa.
Oh, right, okay. You've been there.
And Laura, how did you feel about the... We seem to have talked about this a lot, but how did you feel about those singers as singers?
I love gospel, so I love this program, even though it wasn't, as you say, much of a documentary. I still felt that I learnt stuff and had a more sort of immersive experience, want of a better phrase, than the Gregory Porter program, and that I heard very different voices, and I thought that was the beauty of it. She, even though it's Radio 2, so it's a bit more prime time than a Radio 4 doc, she was unveiling a lot of people, a lot of voices that a lot of people would not have heard on that radio station, and that echoed a lot of other things. So there's things that would then come. So I really love that Kay Robinson track, which was produced by a young James Brown, where she does talky intro, and then it gets quite funky, because the second episode of this gets into gospel funk, doesn't it?
And then also that track by the 9-year-old Sly Stone.
Oh my God, that was amazing. Yeah, it's worth listening to this doc just for that.
So I was kind of, I approached this doc, this programme as quite cynically, because as Michael has alluded to when we were talking about the Gregory Porter thing, things are bolted together for both radio and TV programming. And I have actually made kind of programmes in a previous life like this. Harry Connick Jr.'s Christmas Records is still somewhere. Christmas Jazz will no doubt get a wheel out on Radio 2 this coming holiday period. And so I know quite cynically, in those meetings, if you go in and go, we want to do a show like with crate digging, loads of gospel that nobody's ever heard before, the Radio 2 commissioning editor will probably quite rightfully go raise an eyebrow and go, right, what's the next idea? Is there something stronger? However, if you go in and go, we've got Laura Mavula and she's signed up and she wants to, you know, we want to do, and they'll go, brilliant. But the way that you sell that program is that Laura Mavula will be putting together the records from her own collection. And most of the time that does not happen. Most of the time you've got her for kind of like an hour to record links for like three programs, and you're basically just going, read out this script. And there were some bits in the when she was talking that you could tell came from the script. There was a toe curling bit where I don't believe that Laura Mavula, if she was normally referring to the Reverend Julius Cheeks, would say, "Here's the Reverend Cheeks bearing it all." I think that is from a script that somebody else has written. But there were bits where she was quite obviously, and you could actually tell if you listen through, you can actually kind of tell.
So does Aretha Franklin mean to you?
Yeah,
and that worked really nicely. That was really totally engaging, right? Because it had spontaneous and heartfelt.
And so I thought it could have been a lot worse, and it was actually, it benefits from it, you know, because it wasn't prime time. It's like 10 o'clock at night, isn't it? Yeah. So it's kind of like specialist show.
And there's no secret, of course, how gospel fed into soul and funk and rock and roll, but I was talking to Pete Waterman the other day, who you'll be surprised to
hear. Shall I pick that up for you?
He's not necessarily one of my greatest musical heroes, but a fascinating man, a man with strong opinions about absolutely everything. And he was talking about how he fell in love with music through the church too, but through hymns, through the English hymns. And I was thinking, really? Come on, aren't they a bit boring? He went, you're kidding me, aren't you? Jerusalem, for those in peril on the sea. The carols, these are amazing songs. I said, well, yeah, you're picking the greatest hits there, not the catalogue. He said, yeah, well, all music's like that. The greatest hits are great, the catalogue's boring. That's the nature of music. But we started talking about, you know, how first it gave him an insight into the way the market worked, you know, because you see the congregation, they'll stand up for Jerusalem and for those in peril on the sea. If it's something they don't know and they can't follow the tune, you're going to get nothing. Whereas if you give them something they know, as he said, they'll give it rice. But a thought occurred to me, and I put it to him. So do you think that, you know, the reason America got rock and roll is they had gospel, and the reason we got Tommy Steele and Cliff Richard is that we had hymns? So, well, obviously it's a bit more complicated than that, because there are other things in rock and roll. But yeah, maybe there is something in there. Maybe that is why, you know, English music for a long time was, you know, buttoned up, which is that our church tradition was a very formal music that was about putting the fear of God into you, whereas American church, or black American church music, was about putting the love of God into you.
That's a good theory, and I bet you that next time you see Pete Waterman being interviewed, he will have taken that theory and now be presenting it back to you as his very own.
When we first got a video recorder, I used to tape lots of things off Top of the Pops and Wogan and The Tube. And I've still got a VHS tape of the appearance that your hero, Van Morrison, and Michael's hero, Cliff Richard, made together on Wogan, doing When God Shines His Light. Right, so they did it. It was quite odd, as you would expect, right? And then Derek Jameson, who was
inevitably there,
turns to the camera and goes, there we go, Cliff Richard and Van Morrison. Good looking bloke, isn't he?
Lovely little potato, Van. Before we leave this segment, I would just like to encourage you to look at the Wikipedia entry. I don't know if many of you have heard of Wikipedia. It's a secret journalist tool. On the famous Davis sisters. And only because it's written in the most highfalutin, God-fearing language you've ever read, and it's just a wonder. And describes Ruth Baby Sis Davis's voice as a huge, wide-ranging metallic contralto of great beauty and extraordinary power and force in squalling.
Wow. Well, that's a sentence I use in every single record review I write, regardless of who it's about.
Did you write this thing?
I wrote that about Robert Wyatt once.
And so it is nigh on the end of the show, but we've just got a few minutes for a touch of closing time chatter, where our guests tell us what's caught their attention this week. Han, hello.
Not strictly this week, but I just never had a chance to talk about it. I finished watching it last week, which is the second series of Last Chance You on Netflix. It's been on Netflix for a while. We saw the first series by chance 2 or 3 years ago, and what it is basically is Friday Night Lights, but true. It's about a junior college football team in East Mississippi Community College, set in this tiny town, you know, 3,000 people there, however many. But this college, what it does is snap up the people who've been chucked out of first grade universities, the football players, for whatever misdemeanors, usually some kind of crime. So they're out of college football, and they want to carry on playing football. Their only chance to get back to college football is to go to a junior college, play the game there, and then get snapped up again when it's considered their sins have expired. And they go back to senior college and then go into the NFL. So you get these prodigiously gifted athletes at this tiny little college. And this college, by result of having these players, is basically the best junior college in the country. Keeps winning national championships. The first series was centred around the character, well, not the character, the real person. This woman, Brittany Wagner, who's the academic coordinator, and her efforts to keep these people had no desire to learn anything. On the straight and narrow, and actually doing enough college work they could graduate. The second series became, I thought at first it was going to be more of the same, but became much more fascinating as it went on, because really what it was about, I think, was power, and the power of the coach, this irascible bully, who knows he's an irascible bully and wants not to be an irascible bully but can't stop himself, and the white coaching team, and the power of the white college coaches who are selecting from the junior college, over these poor black kids who are basically meat. They are fodder for a system. That's all they are. I mean, of course, you know, the coaches want these kids to succeed and go on and become NFL players and become rich, but fundamentally they are meat. And that becomes more and more and more apparent as the series goes on. And it's kind of absolutely compelling.
Thank you.
Sounds fantastic.
Mr. Miller.
Two things. The first thing, because I knew Michael was going to be here, is I would like to say Malcolm Young from AC/DC, rock in peace.
Malcolm, one of the greatest musicians in the history of rock.
I found this particular in the current round of the Grim Reaper taking all the good rock musicians from us. This one particularly sad, really. And I was thinking about AC/DC, two of the best gigs I've ever seen have been AC/DC, and how quickly that version of AC/DC has spectacularly gone to pieces, so that Brian had to retire on the spot. Phil Rudd was arraigned under suspicious circumstances, and Malcolm Young has now had a horrible death.
And,
poor man.
And Cliff Williams, the bassist, retired at the end of the last tour as well.
So that's that.
It's now only Angus.
Will they go on, do you think?
I hope not.
Yeah, same here. So there's that.
And your second one?
I'd like to mention that currently on Radio 4 is the second series of Alexei Sayle's Imaginary Sandwich Shop. Now, I cannot believe how funny this programme is or how good it is, even though I really like Alexei Sayle. Mm-hmm. So I'd say to people, listen to it because it's funny, but I'd also say listen to it because it's like hearing someone who's just so good at it, despite the fact that they haven't toured for between something like 25 years. It's like Clint Eastwood at the end of Unforgiven, who doesn't want to come out and murder people, but he's just so good at it, he can't stop himself. And when you hear Alexei read his stuff, which is basically what he's doing, it's stuff that he's written, you can hear him, the greatest, one of the most magical skills, like a great singer in fact, of deciding when he wants to make the audience laugh. When he bites down on one word or one syllable, or he shifts gear slightly.
Yeah.
There's a bit in the episode that I've just listened to where he's talking to a guru, and the guru is saying to him, Alexei, life is like recognising those moments when one door opens and another closes. And I said to him, yeah, I had a Vauxhall Astra like that. Now, you've laughed, even though I didn't do it justice at all. But the specific, if you listen to it, go back to it and listen to it, the way he bites off the phrase Vauxhall Astra enough to get a round of applause from the audience, yeah, it's just magnificent display of technique. And it's just sitting there on Radio 4 at 6:30 where all the other generic Oxbridge stuff normally
sits. No, it's wonderful. It really is.
So,
second that. Matt?
I've got something to listen to as well, which has been out for ages, but in the wake of the death of Charles Manson earlier this week, there's a podcast called You Must Remember This, which comes out from the States, and it's the brainchild and the work of a woman called Karina Longworth, who writes it and performs it, and it's just a voice telling a story. She goes into forensic detail about kind of different stories of kind of Hollywood from long ago, and the second series, which I didn't listen to at the time, but somebody mentioned it on Twitter, and so I had a long drive yesterday, and so I put it on, and it just goes into, if you want to, and I totally understand if you don't want to kind of to understand or to know all the kind of grisly details of that period of American history, and she doesn't sugarcoat it, and she goes into the whole kind of his childhood and the situation in California and the Bay Area and LA and the political politics of Hollywood at the time, and it's just a brilliant listen. And it's not, I'm not telling anybody anything they don't know, because everybody loves this podcast, but it's really good.
I was going to mention Debbie McGee on Strictly Come Dancing dressing as Jerry Halliwell. I don't even watch Strictly Come Dancing, but this bent my mind so much I had to watch a clip. But there's nothing really to say about that other than I don't know what's happening to the world. What I would like to talk about is something that a reader emailed me about. A few years ago, I wrote about Three Before Eight, which are the last three songs played every Wigan Casino all-nighter. And for those of you who don't know, it's Jimmy Radcliffe's Long After Tonight Is All Over, Toby Legend's Time Will Pass You By, and Dean Parrish's I'm On My Way. And this reader told me that Toby Legend has been found in Detroit. She did continue a music career for a while, but she apparently had no idea that this song had ever even been released, and she'd never performed it live until, I think it was the end of last month.
Wow.
And she didn't perform it. And she met the guy who'd written the song. It's just remarkable to me that in this modern internet age could still even be the case. But like,
was she John Legend's mother?
Yeah, probably actually.
It's not a common name.
No.
Chances are they are related.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he pronounced it Legend. And that is the end of the show, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you to Andy Miller and to Michael Hann and, of course, to Matt Hall. Andrew Harrison will be back in the Dungeon of Delights next week. In the meantime, listeners, you can hear this episode of Big Mouth again and all of our past shows at audioboom.com/channel/Big Mouth. Michael Hann, stop yawning while I'm speaking. You can subscribe in the podcast section via Apple Podcasts and the iTunes Music Store. And you can find us on Spotify as well. Thank you very much for listening. We will see you next week.